This is an ABC podcast.
Every leftist position holds an internal inconsistency. All of them. What Carly Fiorina did during the debates about Planned Parenthood was great because it shows the inconsistency of the left. They say they're pro-choice, and they say that it's a moderate position to be pro-choice. And then, I wish that she had actually just brought a picture of a baby at 27 weeks and said, Hillary Clinton wants to kill this, wants you to be able to kill this. Please explain why. Right? It's the inconsistency. You're pro-life, you're pro-children, but you're okay with killing this. So the only other reason that you should ever have a conversation or be friends with anyone on the left is, and not even be friends, is if you are in public in front of a large audience, and then your goal is to humiliate them as badly as possible. That is the goal of the conversation.
Well, if you've been anywhere near YouTube over the past few years, you're going to recognize Ben Shapiro there, the conservative American political commentator who's become something of a rock star in a certain genre of YouTube video, the one where someone destroys someone else in a debate. Ben is an arch destroyer, and his secret weapon, according to his many fans, is a certain kind of intelligence based on the ruthless deployment of pure reason. So does this make Ben Shapiro a model citizen, or is he perhaps a symptom of something deeply corrosive in the way that we engage with each other? On RN, you're in the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. Welcome to the program. According to the analytic philosophical tradition, reason is supposed to be a cure for dogmatic thinking and an essential ingredient in any recipe for a harmonious society. But really, spend 5 seconds on social media these days and you'll find yourself wondering if reason is maybe failing us, or at least if there's a sense in which reason has been co-opted into a form of public discourse that's really anything but reasonable. And it raises the question, is reason enough to make good citizens? Well, today this is all being thrashed out by three highly reasonable, but not excessively reasonable, philosophers. One is Tim Dean, who's an honorary associate at the University of Sydney.
Perhaps philosophers, and I would include myself in this, have overestimated the power of reason to solve all the problems that we've got to solve. But also we've overestimated perhaps the capacity that we have to employ reason. And I've wrestled with that, and I've changed my mind a little bit now to realize that reason might be a necessary part of the picture, but it's not sufficient.
We're also going to be hearing from Matt Beard, who's a fellow at the Ethics Centre in Sydney, and he's the resident philosopher on Short and Curly, which is the ABC's ethics podcast for kids and families.
I think to some extent it's about thinking about reason and rationality, not just in terms of their power in order for us to solve problems or prosecute issues. So philosophers have never thought about reason and rationality just as a tool. They've thought about it as an expression of who we are, of what it means to be human, of what it means to be social, is to be a rational animal, to engage in discourse in a particular way. And I've got a lot of sympathy for that view. I do think that that's an important part of what it means to be human, but I don't think it's exclusively what defines us as human and what makes us the best kind of society and the best kind of individual is one who is exclusively rational.
And we also have Laura D'Olimpio, no stranger to this program, and she's senior lecturer in philosophy of education at the University of Birmingham in the UK.
Yeah, I think that reason still really is very important, and the idea of critical thinking, I would say, is more important than ever before. So I don't think philosophers are wrong about that, but it's not going to be the only thing we need to live well or to get along well with others. And I think that some things like educating the emotions and notions of virtues and compassion are also really important, so that when we are judging a situation, we're not just seeing others as abstract sort of conceptual ideas that are in the landscape of, well, what do I want to do and what's impeding my action, but rather sort of fully fleshed out human beings with lives and thoughts and feelings of their own, and that they're trying to live a good life too.
It's important to think as well, not just about what use does reason serve, but why else we might care about reason, because it does have, sure, some instrumental value, as, by the way, does having, you know, a trustworthy relationship with another person. But that's not the only reason we care about having a trusting relationship. That's not the only reason why we care about being reasonable. We care about these things not just because they're useful, but because they're good and because they're valuable. So I think to that extent, philosophers have been right to capture the importance of being rational, of not just accepting the norms and trends of society as they're dictated to us, but to interrogate those and make sure that we want to own them. But philosophers have fallen into the trap of suggesting that reason is primary in defining us as who we are, that we are who we are because of our ability to use reason. And reason for philosophers has a particular set of rules. There is a right and a wrong way to be rational about problems. What that has tended to do is favor certain voices and certain modes of thinking. It's tended to favor men who have been seen as more abstract thinkers and more rational thinkers at the expense of women who have been deemed to be more emotional. It's favored more individualistic ways of identifying ourselves as a single free thinker over communal ways of defining ourselves and understanding ourselves. So I guess that's a way of saying, yes, there is a role, and it's right that we identify reason as having an important role, but it sits within a much richer tapestry of what it means to resolve a problem, of what it means to identify as a person or identify as part of a community.
And we need to sort of have this sympathetic engagement with the idea of the other and recognize that that doesn't actually, in my opinion, dissipate into complete relativism where, well, we can't hope to understand one another because we all have such individual perspectives. It's taking seriously those individual perspectives and recognizing that we still have shared common interests and that we all want to get on well and live a good life without facing harm. And in the light of huge global, you know, crises that we are facing and will continue to face, I feel like we do need to find a way to reclaim this shared language, this shared trust in one another. Because what I'm worried about is that we've got this divisiveness. And so I'm wondering what skills we need to be good or civil or virtuous or decent citizens. And if we think that reason is one of those skill sets, well, what else is needed as well?
I think what I think about in this conversation is a quote from G.K. Chesterton, where he talks about what he calls the lucidity of madmen. And what he has in mind is a certain kind of person who he thinks their worldview is mad, is kind of doesn't hold up. But the mad person isn't mad because they've lost their reason. They're mad because they've lost everything else except their reason. And for this kind of person, the complexities of the interior life of the other mean nothing. The significance of the ecology of the world and environmental systems where we can't necessarily measure their value in utilitarian terms are insignificant. The idea of traditions with which that person doesn't think makes sense based on their own world ought not to be given value when we're making judgments about what's right or wrong. That's the person who has made the world so simple and so mundane, has flattened out the sophistication of experience. They are the kind of person who is vulnerable to being seduced by arguments that imitate reason, that use kind of sophisticated language, or they play the game of talking about logical fallacies and they provide cherry-picked facts and they impersonate rational arguments. And because that's all that that person speaks of, their reason literacy is fairly good, but their emotional literacy is very low. Their willingness to engage in alternate points of view or different experiences is entirely removed. I think that person is quite vulnerable to being misled in that kind of environment. So I do think that the idea of emotional intelligence that gets bandied around a lot is quite significant. I also think that we need to think of ourselves not exclusively in individual terms, because that leads us to thinking about my reason and my perspective in competition with yours. It plays into the problem that we face whenever we're running a thought experiment or talking about an idea in a classroom where we say, it's not the case that each of us is trying to win the argument here. We are in a shared activity in pursuit of truth.
And you know, that's actually why I've changed my mind over the last 12 months, because I've been teaching critical thinking. I think we all have, right, for quite a while. And we've all done some work in schools as well, trying to get more philosophy into schools. And typically philosophy in schools is usually critical thinking and ethics. But even within ethics, it's framed around kind of ethical reasoning, ways of thinking through ethical problems in a kind of a rational, in a kind of enlightenment sort of way. And I've been teaching that for a while, and I've been getting increasingly disillusioned with the outcome, because I feel as though I've been giving people a bunch of tools that they will probably never use, because they're never going to get, or it's unlikely, or it's rare for them to get into the kind of conversation where those tools are appropriate to use. So what we don't want is, and what I think I've been seeing, is you teach people about logical fallacies and, you know, ad hominems and slippery slopes and that kind of thing, and you teach them about, you know, logical problems of validity and stuff. And when they're used, they can be used in anger in a way that makes a conversation go worse rather than better. And you start flinging around, hey, you just did a slippery slope, and that just offends the other person. And, hey, your argument is invalid because of this, this, and this, but it doesn't actually get towards a solution. Or even if someone presents a position and you tear it down rationally, but then they don't change their mind, it's because you weren't actually engaging with the real reason that they believed something. There was probably just some post hoc rationalization that they chucked out. And we see this all the time. And so what I've realized is that there was something that I was missing. And so I'm now changing the way that I teach critical thinking, where there are two components of it, at least two components. But the major component that it was missing was building trust and respect, and building the possibility for people to get into the kind of social stance where you can disagree with someone safely and constructively, rather than in a way that is just going to butt up against identity issues and make people defensive and make people kind of fall into a particular camp or want to call someone out or start moralizing and saying, oh, you believe this, therefore you're this kind of person. And I've realized I've got to do so much more work in the way that I present my materials, so that by the time I get to the critical thinking, they're already good at listening. They're already good at engaging and understanding and empathizing, so that when the critical thinking kicks in, like Matt, like you said, it's not, I'm not here to beat you. I'm not here to win an argument. I'm here to join you as a fellow truth seeker, and we can understand each other's views better. And maybe we don't change each other's minds, but we have a really good conversation and we build social capital. We build a bit of trust and respect.
One of the problems is when philosophy, I guess, doesn't quite value the applied skill set that goes hand in hand with how do I be reasonable? Well, I need to be reasonable in relation to the conversations, others, these ideas. It's no good if I'm sitting in my ivory tower on my own, thinking very logically and clearly. How can that help us in the world? And, you know, you go back to the Stoics and back to ancient Greece. There was this sense that philosophy was meant to be therapeutic and that it's meant to help us live the good life. So the question is, well, can it actually do that? I mean, I would like to think that it does, but I have to separate the ideal of, say, a community of inquiry or of people coming together and having these discussions with the reality. And we've all three of us mentioned that people aren't perfectly rational. They get defensive, they get emotional, they're easily confused and swayed by these sensationalized arguments. And if we start to feel threatened, we are defensive and shut down and forget that the other is like us. And we forget that we can converse with them, even if we disagree. And so we have to recognize the ideal dialogue is inclusive and supportive, and we're all aiming towards truth. But in actuality, in reality, it will reinforce some of the existing problems, power discriminations, and other stereotypes that we see reflected in public discourse more widely. But here I do think there is a special role, not just for philosophy in schools, but for public philosophy, provided people are well trained or educated to do so, to try and give exemplars, and they might be called moral exemplars, but show how we can reasonably disagree, that we don't have to agree with one another to keep trying to move forward together to find solutions or clarify concept or seek truth.
On RN, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone and a three-way conversation this week with Laura D'Olimpio, Matt Beard and Tim Dean, all homegrown philosophers who are grappling with the question of whether reason is perhaps a little overrated in forming good citizens. And if reason's not enough, then what else do we need?
For me, I think there's a couple of things to to pick apart. The first is a couple of times we've articulated this idea that we are all kind of seekers of truth. That may be true in the ideal, that's not true in practice. We know that a number of the people who are utilizing the current landscape have no interest in what's true. They have interest in basically shoring up what is going to make them money or keep them powerful. And ultimately, those two things usually wind up being the same. But the other one is more to speak to the social media point, which is that so often we are talking because we feel like we need to, because we feel like it's important to demonstrate our maturity and our sophistication that we express an opinion on everything that's going on. So based on the news of the day, we can all suddenly be experts in fire reduction strategies in New South Wales because that's what happens to be the news of the day. And it really reminds me of what Harry Frankfurt's talking about when he talks about bullshit and the actual idea of bullshit being what you say when you feel like you should say something, but you know nothing about what you're talking about. What Frankfurt doesn't talk so much about are the social forces that make us feel compelled to offer just as so much bullshit. And I think social media, because it affords rewards and encourages us to communicate in these very pithy, short ways that track engagement, encourages us to think in that way. So to think without being too diagnostic about the current environment, one of the questions I'm interested in is how do we generate the kind of person who, when they dive into this new landscape, has a different set of incentives, who, even in the face of knowing that there are big opportunities available to them if they decide not to play the truth game, if they decide to play the power game instead, if they decide to play the engagement game, that they actually have strong internal reasons for not playing that game. And that makes me think about something that I know Scott Stevens at the ABC, the Minefield and Religion Ethics has talked about, where he thinks that moral formation needs to come prior to this kind of critical analysis and critical thinking so that we know the ends to which we need to dedicate this critical thinking before we actually engage in the process itself. And that's the kind of thinking that I'm starting to come around to a little bit for precisely those reasons.
I agree that there is a space that's very important for individual skills and education that includes critical thinking. It includes moral formation of the virtues and cultivating notions of compassion and respect and things like that. I think that that's absolutely paramount. And we can see people, individuals and young people, using the social media tools for their advantage in seeking and promoting truth and getting a message out there. The classic example being Greta Thunberg and her voice and her action on climate change. And I think the response to Greta has been incredible. And it shows that there is a desire to do good, to connect, to unite, and to promote a message of truth and want to live well together as a global community. But I do think that to do that, in some ways, you're using those technological tools and social media, but you're fighting against some of the inbuilt restrictions of those same social media platforms. And given the online space where bots are designed to be more effective than any single individual user of social media, and they will propagate the most sensational and, you know, problematic voices online. And what that does for the majority of people is just create confusion and noise. And so it's not that they're simply wanting, I think, for the majority of people in a democracy, for example, they're not just wanting to, you know, play the game of power politics, but I think there's a lot of confusion. I still want to believe this sort of hopeful, idealistic vision that they are still trying to choose the best for themselves, but I don't think they are. So I feel as if there's the individual education that needs to occur that includes this rationality and moral education, but then this has to be supported by policies and governments and maybe even a global approach that puts certain kinds of restrictions on social media, certain kinds of voices, certain kinds of journalism that just isn't telling the truth or that is confusing. And so there has to be a reduction of bots. There has to be, you know, this idea that untruths aren't put forward. So like The Conversation just decided that they're going to not give a platform to anti-vaxxers or climate change deniers because it's just too important to not confuse the public on these issues. I think more of that needs to happen.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I've got a very conflicted feeling about free speech at the moment. I wrote recently in an article for the Ethics Centre about how free speech in a way requires people to already be more kind of rational and critical thinking and scrutinizing of ideas than we naturally are. And if we are not already equipped to be able to filter out that noise, the noise overwhelms us. And Matt, as you said, the people playing the money game or the power game tend to do really well when it's noisy like that. And it becomes this vicious circle. It becomes this circular thing, right? Like, and so I'm now at the point where I'm sympathetic to some restrictions on speech and, like you said, Laura, some restrictions on and regulation of what social media companies can do and what some media companies to do. I don't want that to be the lasting solution. To me, that's like treating an acute problem with some medication, but you do longer-term therapy to rebuild strength. This is whether it's a physical or mental ailment. You rehabilitate. And you don't need the medication, you don't need the acute intervention anymore. I would like to see that rehabilitation in terms of the kind of moral and critical and, you know, philosophical education that we have. But we're talking like a decades-long kind of project there to rebuild social capital, to rebuild the way we think about what appropriate discourse looks like.
Yeah, I would add to that that perhaps another way of thinking about it, which kind of speaks to this general notion of, you know, some kinds of truths that we're aiming at in terms of rationality are truths that we can express in analytic terms. But I'm not convinced that everything that is true in a more general sense can be expressed in that way. I'm really sympathetic to someone like Ray Gaider's argument that we should stop talking about ideas like respect and dignity and start talking about something like preciousness when it comes to humanity. Something that we can't fully express what it means for another person in their infinite kind of complexity and vulnerability, what they actually mean in terms of moral value, that we can't express that fully, but we can appreciate it. And to me, I think that's a sort of a starting point to capture some of this, if we can begin there, because it gives something that if we can set that up, that orients our choices from that point on. We work with this understanding when it comes to truth that it's sufficient to demonstrate that something is true or right in order to persuade someone of it. I'm not convinced that's true, ironically. I think that it's not enough to show someone that you are correct or that someone will recognize the truth and go, well, that's right, and therefore I'm changing my mind. What we believe is so tied up with who we think we are in terms of identity, of who we're connected to, of who we're bonded to, and what we already think is the case in ambiguous situations. And so I think we need to start with something that we can all agree on, because I'm not sure that we all agree that truth is the most important thing. But I wonder if something like what Gaider's talking about with preciousness is something that we could all kind of get on board for.
Tied into that idea about the kinds of people that we see ourselves as being, I think that the stories we tell and the stories that resonate with us are very significant and powerful. And I think that even the stories that we tell about ourselves, we come to believe, even if it's a maybe different story to the story someone else might tell. And so when we're using social media, we're often telling stories, and individual experiences can be very persuasive to people who are trying to figure out whether or not they should vaccinate their kid. If someone tells one individual story, that can be very persuasive and certainly appeal to emotions and sway someone despite whatever all of the evidence and facts are that are laid out before them, perfectly rational. So I think that there needs to be a lot of attention given to which stories we tell and promote. And as soon as we like, share, promote, repeat these stories more and more and more, people also remember them. So there might be a fact checker that comes later to sort of say, well, that actually didn't happen. But people remember the story, not the correction. And this is how these myths are reinforced. And so I don't want to get rid of this idea of truth and reason, because I think that we need to see how the stories we tell can support the actual voices of experts and the actual facts. But we have to be mindful of how they're received. And you're both right to point out that they're received in a context, in a situated space and time as people who have certain experiences. And that idea of how we communicate our position, our stories, how do we bring other people into the conversation is something that I think philosophers haven't done as well as they could have, generally speaking.
Look, it's such a good point about stories. And I suppose talking about in terms of education and how we teach this and how we weave that in, something that I've been thinking about recently is the idea that reason doesn't persuade, which is what you were saying, Matt. Reason justifies. And I think as a bit of a slogan, I kind of keep that in the back of my mind, that reason doesn't persuade, reason justifies. And that helps me to justify some of the stories that I tell. And the example that I use for this is Jonathan Swift. And it's one of my favorite quotes from Jonathan Swift. He's writing a letter to one of his friend, Alexander Pope. And he's critiquing the idea of the rational animal. He says, no, humans are not, you know, animal rationale, this Latin idea for the rational animal. He says, no, we're rationis capax, which is Latin to say we are just capable of reason, but we're not always rational and we don't always choose to employ the reason. And he said this in the context of saying, I've got this new treatise that is going to demonstrate this point really clearly. And that book that he wrote was not a philosophical treatise. It was Gulliver's Travels. He told a story. He told a story that was funny and witty and satirical and engaging and cheeky and challenging. And it makes a point. But behind it, there is reason. He didn't use rational argument in the storytelling, but you can unpack it rationally if you wanted to later. And I actually think the story is far more persuasive to his point than if he did just lay everything out rationally. But it's good to know those two things were there complementing each other.
And I think you're right, Tim, that we need to have trust and respect as an underlying, because otherwise the stories of fear, which are divisive, are much more powerful than anything that is just rational and factual. Fear will sway us, but so too will love. So when we have notions of stories that are based on reason, that can build trust and connection and, you know, stir our love rather than our fear, I think then we can move forward. But philosophers need to, I guess, understand this and get on board as well.
Laura D'Olimpio, Senior Lecturer in Philosophy of Education at the University of Birmingham. You also heard Tim Dean, Freelance Philosopher and Honorary Associate at the University of Sydney, and Matt Beard, who's a Fellow at the Ethics Centre in Sydney, and he's also Philosopher in Residence with Short and Curly, which is the ABC's excellent ethics podcast for kids. And that's the Philosopher's Zone for this week. You can listen again via the ABC Listen app. My name is David Rutledge. You can tweet me at David P. Zone. And it's been great to have your company. Thanks for listening. See you next time.